Hello and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This podcast is brought to you by Texas Citizens Bank. Through good and tough times, you need a bank that will stand by you. Texas Citizens Bank gives Houston small and medium-sized businesses the resources they need to thrive. As one customer says, a huge thank you to our friends at Texas Citizens Bank. Great customer service and down-to-earth good people. Call 713-948-5700 to learn more today. My guest for this episode is Dr. Toby Hamilton, founder of Hamilton Health Box, a Houston startup that's bringing affordable preventative health care directly to patients. Dr. Hamilton joins the show today to discuss the company's unique approach as well as the future of health innovation in Houston. Toby, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I know we have a lot to discuss today. Your career in health tech entrepreneurship is very vast. So to get started, give us a brief overview on how you found your way into health innovation and entrepreneurship.
Well, I became a physician and intended to make practicing emergency medicine the be-all end-all. And most of us that are physicians know the commitment school-wise and education-wise. And so you're looking at an 11 to 15-year process. And so I always assumed that that's what I would be doing for the rest of my life. But as I got into the space and learned more and more about the needs and the shortcomings and the way it's so dysfunctional, I almost got backed into trying to find some ways to do things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking at the more entrepreneurial side of the business, really in an attempt to change my work environment to something that was a little more palatable.
Very interesting. So you launched your company, Hamilton Health Box, right kind of ahead of the pandemic. So I wanted to kind of launch right into that conversation on how, you know, what your original goals were with Hamilton Health Box, you know, what those were at the time, and then how did the pandemic change things?
Yeah, Hamilton Health Box is a company that really was designed to deliver the lowest possible price primary and preventative care. I don't believe you can design an effective model to deliver primary and preventative care less expensively than the one that we've designed. And we built that to be able to take that healthcare, that primary preventative care piece, to the job site and sort of meet the customer where they're at. And the end result of that would be that we would get better outcomes. You know, the modern world that we're living in dictates that everything is brought to us, right? Our food is delivered to us and our shows are delivered and movies are delivered to our home. Healthcare is one place where we're technologically behind. And so this was a way to sort of move that ball forward in a cost-effective way. And it was also designed to get that same low-cost primary and preventative care into the hands and into the lives of people that need it most. Probably one of the biggest travesties that I've seen in my lifetime growing up in a blue-collar community was that these men and women could work as hard as they did 40 hours a week and not even be close to being able to afford any type of real healthcare benefits. And that just, it never sat right with me that we don't have a way to take care of many of the people that do our hardest work. And this is an attempt at addressing that issue.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because I don't know if you've observed this too, but I definitely feel like there's a cultural difference in America regarding healthcare. Is you associate healthcare with extremely expensive, and B, you associate it with when you're sick, you go find healthcare. So it's almost like we have to change everyone's mind about that, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think we can get people to generally agree with the concept that we want to be preventative and we want to be in front of our illnesses and make a difference before things get bad, before we're really sick. The issue is acting on that. is a whole nother dynamic. I have to have the time to go to the doctor. I have to have the time to go to the lab. I have to have the money to go to the lab and go to the doctor. I have to find a place that's in my network. I have to take time off work to go get this done. There's a ton of really what they are is practical barriers to ever getting around to getting primary preventative care.
So, you know, you launched the company and the pandemic hits. What were you thinking at that time? And then kind of in the long run, how did the pandemic affect Hamilton Health Books?
Well, we were lucky in that we had completed our first year. We ran an experiment, if you will. We had one customer. We designed it that way. And we wanted to spend a year inside of that business trying to see if this new model, this new approach was going to be cost effective and health-wise effective for the customer. And we did so. And luckily, that one-year experiment ended, in March of 19, right, when things really started hitting the fan. And so we had a year's worth of data telling us that the services we were providing are effective and impactful. The issue is everybody after that was just trying to survive, right? Everybody was laying people off, and the dynamic around attempting to get a new product into the market was not a good one. It was a bad time to be going to market. But at the same time, there was a new need for all kinds of testing, education, helping HR departments determine who needs to come in and who doesn't need to come in, education around vaccinations. And so for the next year, after our one-year experiment, we really spent a lot of time addressing the needs of our customers, which was largely around COVID. So the next year, we became pretty significant experts in COVID as much as we could. And we picked up a book of business that was big enough and interesting enough that led to relationships that we now can turn them into really more of a standard customer we're not post pandemic, but it slowed down enough to where people are rehiring and the economy's got its legs back.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you mentioned the idea of kind of meeting patients where they are, and you mentioned your clients too. So how exactly does the business model work? Who are your clients specifically, and how are you reaching patients kind of through them, I guess?
Today, we focus largely on self-insured employers. And the reason is because those self-insured employers are ultimately responsible for the healthcare costs of their employees. And therefore, we have an aligned interest in getting their employees healthy. When their employees are unhealthy and have to use resources, it costs the company real money. And so it's great to go into a company where we both have a shared goal of getting a population healthy. Their motivation is that they want their population healthy and productive at work, but they also want it to save money. And for us, being a healthcare company, we're really focused on taking care of people that need our help, that need our care. You know, we want to take care of people that at times may not be willing or have the knowledge to take care of themselves. So that was sort of the focus of the company and how we've been approaching the market broadly.
Gotcha. So in 2019, you mentioned working with kind of one participant for on this experiment. Now, where are you at in 2021, and where do you expect to be in 2022 in terms of, you know, the volume of service, I guess?
Yeah, we've got, we're up to thousands of lives now that we're managing at any given point in time. And, we're in double digit customers with a pipeline that's pretty robust. I think we're getting enough feedback to tell us that the market is interested in this type of care. And I think more time goes on, the more we're able to identify our value proposition very distinctly for our future customers. And that is, we're actually able to get more healthcare, more primary care to your employees at a lower cost than you've ever paid before, which ultimately is resulting in fairly significant savings on the big expenditure, the big ticket items. And there's also a return that sometimes doesn't get recognized in the dollars and cents, but when the employees have the sense and the emotion and the feeling that their bosses, that their company cares about their health and well-being, instead of just ignoring their health, they're saying to them, hey, I care enough about your health and well-being that I'm actually going to bring a provider onto the job site, and we're going to use this company to get this population healthy. It's a winning message in most cases. Yeah. The employees appreciate that effort and that commitment to their well-being. And the company really reaps that, that reward if they position it correctly. So what we do in a nutshell is we take, a nurse, for example, and we put them onto a job site of a self-assured employer. And we tend to focus on the market that's, say, companies that are below 1,000 employees. We're always happy to take an employer that has multi-thousands of employees, but there is a much larger market in the smaller company space, the smaller self-assured employer, what we call a mid-market company. And we focus on that customer. And because we've developed operational efficiencies that let us take the care down to a very, very low cost price point, it lets us deliver those services into that market that previously, if you were a company that was that small, these type of services were not available to you. They're cost prohibitive. So we feel that we've implemented a ton of operational efficiencies that just reduce the overhead and the general cost expenditures in delivering primary preventative care. At the same time, creating that access and convenience that's so fundamental to really do this successfully. Look, the chances of most of our employees getting in their car, driving to the doctor, missing a half day of work, paying a copay, going to the lab afterwards, getting that done, paying another copay. The reality is probably less than half of the employees are going to do that, especially if they feel otherwise fine. Hey, I feel fine. Why would I go waste my day off and spend all this money for things that are going to be normal? I know I'm okay. And contrast that with, I've got a nurse that's two doors down the hallway. It's a private place. It's a private scenario. My electronic medical record, all of my data is completely private. And I just need to take a quick 15-minute break and walk down the hall. I can do it at my lunch break. I can do it just before work. I can do it just after work. And I've got access to my care team. We assign a care team to you, a physician, sometimes a physician assistant, and a nurse are assigned to that discrete population. And so with time, you establish a relationship. And now going down to visit that nurse down the hallway for a 15-minute visit is really not that big of a deal at all. If you're going to make it that easy for me, I don't mind doing my preventative and primary care. And I don't mind getting my diabetes under control and my blood pressure under control because it's convenient. Just like everything else that we do and every service that we get, there's nothing more convenient than coming to work. And work is the one place where we've got a captive audience. It's the one place that you've got to go in. Every American has to go to work for the most part. And so we've got a great captive audience, making it easy and cost effective for them to access this primary preventative care. And so that nurse works with the team of physicians and PAs to deliver that care. Sometimes they do it via telemedicine. We've got some very advanced technologies that let us, the nurse can use a stethoscope and I can hear those sounds wherever I may be. They've got otoscopes and ophthalmoscopes that we can put in your ears and your mouth, and I can see all of those images no matter where I am. And we end up having the physician spend some time there face-to-face for patients that need or are more comfortable with a face-to-face visit, or maybe we're looking to establish the relationship a little more effectively. But then the other times we'll say, hey, look at this cool technology. I may not be here next time, but my nurse will be here and she's going to help us do the physical exam, and we'll draw your blood right here and we'll send it to the lab right here. And we can take care of all of their primary preventative care needs right there from inside the job site. And so it becomes so accessible and convenient that we end up really moving the needle for this population and helping them avoid some of the unforeseen illnesses that are lurking, right? As we age, there's all kinds of illnesses that are lurking just under the cover, from breast cancer and diabetes and high blood pressure. And we tend to ignore them until a bomb drops, until it explodes in our face. And this gives us an opportunity to get in front of that and really manage the health and well-being of said population.
Yeah. I think it there are people listening right now that are just like, wow, that could be done, because it's such a difference. And like I mentioned earlier, like the culture of going to the doctor. I mean, so many people, I would bet like the majority of people don't have a primary care doctor they go to on a regular basis. And so I know from personal experience, trying to find a doctor is really hard. It's like no new patients and everything, kind of wall after wall trying to do that. So, and the reason being, we have a limited supply of doctors just in Houston. And how do you see this kind of model addressing the fact that, you know, it's hard to find a doctor's appointment sometime, especially, you know, primary care and setting up that relationship? It's like, it's a lot.
I think that access and convenience that I spoke of is the real key. That nurse that's at the job site taking care of the 300 employees or 400 employees at that site, they might only see 5 visits a day. You know, it may not be a huge number. And the rest of the day, they're doing case management work. They're arranging the appointments for the specialists. They're setting somebody up for a surgery, and they're working on behalf of that population. But backing up, just because they're seeing a lesser number of volume of patients, it gives them the time they need to see those patients for an extended period of time if needed. I can see you back the next day as much as I want, because those services are all provided to those employees for free. Now, the employer is paying for those services, don't get me wrong, but the employee experiences them as free. The employer is motivated to send those patients to us because they know that we're delivering the lowest cost price of care, that our primary care visits are going to be less expensive than what they're getting in the market. And we're going to do it for a fraction of the amount of time that it would be required normally to get something like that done. And so, you know, everybody ends up winning. We don't have problems with getting those appointments met. As you said, those barriers are gone. It's free. Just show up and say, hey, here I am. I want to see a doctor. And we'll beam up your doctor. As a matter of fact, we assign that doctor to a set number and a limited number of work sites, which is why they'll go there in person sometimes. Sometimes they go there to the next site in person, but they're always available to take those calls, which is usually a relatively limited number. So again, access, convenience, and availability are some of the really big benefits of a model like this.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the future of Hamilton Health Box, what do you have kind of lined up for next year, which is right around the corner, and you know, for the years to come, what's your ultimate vision as well?
You know, I'll tell you, 2022 is going to be a big year for us. We're really excited about some of the projects that we've got going on. We have an experiment looking at rural care, because this is the lowest cost way to deliver primary preventative care effectively. This model can be applied to areas that have been hard to reach, hard to get to, and hard to treat. I'm excited about the opportunity to take. We are planning to take approximately 10 units, if you will, 10 sites into rural America, and manage that set population there around those towns of 2,000 people, 4,000 people, towns that are one-stop light towns, dropping a clinical unit into those and seeing if we can impact the care of those rural care employees. And that is super exciting, because we are hoping to solve you know, one of the biggest problems in healthcare is rural care. You read about it all the time. If you read anything about healthcare, we don't know how to treat these people. We don't know how to take care of them. We don't know how to get them the specialists that they need. And we certainly don't know how to do it in a cost-effective way. It usually costs more, in fact, for us to get those services out where these people live. This model gives us the opportunity to explore the impact of having somebody very close in your community. But again, I'm not requiring a full doctor's office with rent and electricity and all of those dynamics that come into it. I don't need a front office staff of three people to check people in to be seen. I really just need a very highly trained and well-regarded person who's a part of that community servicing that rural population. So all that being said, we are running a rural America experiment that is, I think, going to be really revolutionary. I mean, I hate to use that word because it becomes so cliche, but I'm really, really excited about it. You know, we model a little bit of this after what Costa Rica had done. And if you look at Costa Rican healthcare, even though they have a fraction of the resources that we have, I mean, an utter fraction, they have longer lifespans and better health outcomes than Americans do. And when we started looking at what was going on there, what we realized was they were doing exactly what I'm describing, which is they're taking a doc, giving them a team of other interested parties, caseworkers and nurses, and they're going periodically into that smaller community and delivering those services to them. They know those people are unlikely to come in town to get their care. They've got other things to do, I guess, when they come to town. But we can create a model that's similar. It's not exactly the same. This is the American version. But we can create a model that's similar and hope and expect to have outcomes that are comparable to what Costa Rica has. So that's a big part of our year. Let me give you another example of something that we're working on in next year that I think is right in that vein. When we look at truck drivers, truck drivers are 6 of every 100 jobs in the United States are a truck driver. I didn't know that either. We're learning a lot about truck drivers. And at the same time, they have some of the worst health of any of our working populations. They just, you know, healthcare is not readily available to them. They're on the road living a very sedentary lifestyle. And many of them develop chronic illnesses as a result, diabetes, high blood pressure, et cetera. We are working to place our sort of care units into the truck stops that they frequent. And that would give us the opportunity to engage with these truck drivers while they're stopping to gas up for a minute or take a short nap or grab a snack. It'll give us the opportunity to reach these populations that, for the most part, have been unreachable. And so that's another exciting experiment. And it is because of its social impact, right? So if 6 of every 100 drivers in the country all of a sudden has an ability to get their care taken care of effectively and cost effectively, that's something that you get to go home feeling good about yourself and the work that you're doing. You know, you get to know that you made a difference in a lot of people's lives, people that are working really hard and need to be taken care of. We want them to be healthy and happy. I think society at large does. We just haven't figured out how to do it within the current confines of the healthcare structures as they exist today. And I think this is going to be we're going to take a really great shot at that. We're going to see if we can't make a difference in those people's lives.
Yeah. You know, providing solutions for rural areas is definitely one of those great challenges that I love to see that you're tackling. And it's definitely a conversation I've had several times on how to innovate this space. Kind of speaking of, you know, healthcare innovation more generally, you know, I know you founded the Healthcare Innovators Professional Society, a local nonprofit. What were you aiming to do when you set out to launch that nonprofit and kind of what's the presence you have now?
Yeah, the Healthcare Innovators Professional Society, or HIPS as we call it, the group members call themselves hipsters, is a collection of chief innovation and chief strategy officers of major health systems across the country. And I'll give you a little background on some of that. I previously founded a company called Emerus in 06, and I I ran that for 10 years. We built it up from, you know, 2 employees to 2,000 over that 10 years. And when I left running the company, we had about 30 hospitals that were functional across the country. And we were running a big hospital system. And we go into these markets and partnered with the healthcare systems as we went into those markets. Well, as we were doing that, what we learned is this new role had popped up. And when I say it was a new, the average person had been on the job at that time less than a year frequently. Even today, the chief innovation officer of most healthcare systems has been on the job for around 3 years or less. But what we found is that person's role was fairly critical to innovation inside of that system. That person was frequently filtering out ideas as they come in, deciding which ones get implemented. They had veto power over what doesn't get implemented. And every single one of them, when we sold into those markets, was really operating on an island. They were running experiments as if they were all one-off. Everything was happening for the first time. And when you look around at general societies, right? I've got a physician society that I'm a part of, and we've got, you know, accountant societies. What we didn't have was a society for innovation officers inside of healthcare systems to connect, communicate, share ideas. And it was my hope at that time that by creating a society of these innovation officers, they would be willing to share information with each other that would then expedite innovation across the landscape. And so for practical purposes, we may have somebody on the East Coast that tried out a company with a new concept, company X, and it moved the needle for them financially, and it impacted their outcomes to a positive degree. And now they want to go into somewhere on the West Coast. Well, what was historically happening is each one of them was having to run the gauntlet entirely. You run an experiment independently and then hope for implementation. But if the one on the East Coast is willing to say to the one on the West Coast, hey, we ran it. Here's our outcomes. Here's our data. This is a no-brainer. You should just go ahead and move on this. What we're actually doing is not only growing that company, but more importantly, what we're doing is we're driving innovation across the country in a very communal way, so that these two organizations are not competitive with one another, but what they are is willing to share their good ideas so that everybody can advance and move the ball forward a little bit faster. Healthcare is really slow to adapt to innovation. These types of relationships are frequently critical to innovation being spread from health system to health system. So we limited the membership to 33 members. There's only 33 healthcare innovators involved in this organization. And we try to give them regional exclusivity as much as possible so that when they are sharing their ideas, they don't feel like they're sharing with their competitor who might come and damage their position in the market. And it's really based on a lot of personal relationships over time. These people have all really become friends and family of sorts. They're all attending the same conferences and they're sharing ideas, but it's been an incredible experience to see the need for this type of an organization, but more importantly, to see the impact that they're doing as they're helping each other solve sometimes very complicated problems. And that's been rewarding. And so that's a little bit of the background on HIPS and that nonprofit organization that we'd started several years ago now.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I've had a few, you know, chief innovation officers or whatever their title is mm-hmm. on the show, and their challenges are very very interesting, because yeah, they're the first of their kind at their hospital, and it's a lot of pressure. What are some of the challenges specifically that you found that they're facing today, the biggest ones kind of on their plate?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, there were some that just stood out right away. Number one, they get put in a box. Sometimes there's a chief innovation officer, but they don't directly report to the CEO. And that is a structural error at this point in time. If they are not directly reporting to the CEO or someone right next to the CEO, maybe the COO, they generally are set up for failure. They're just, they can't, they need power and influence to test and to experiment and to get alignment with the clinical staff as they're going through these things. And that's only going to be achieved with the senior level leadership engaging in those innovative processes. I think that's one of the big challenges. The second one is setting aside the budget for it, right? So we've never had a department of innovation or an innovation team. And all of a sudden, you've got to take people and time and resources and set them aside and have analysts and people looking at the information. You've got to have operators that can implement the program successfully. So that, you know, you've got to get a budget and you've got to be sitting next to the leadership inside of the health system. And then I think lastly, one of the biggest ones is really identifying that organization's goals. There's so many new ideas and so many new concepts that are bombarding these innovation officers that they could spend all of their time and their team's time just filtering out an idea or two. They really need to identify, hey, our organization is focused on decreasing inpatient days or whatever their focus is, and really focus down to looking at companies that are looking to address that problem. It's easy for them to get really broad and address a bunch of problems and not do any of them very well. So most of what I'm seeing is, hey, let's work on, here's the three problems we want to work on this year. Let's get the companies that might help us do that from the outside, evaluate them, get information from the other hipsters as to how they've done. And then we can use that information to implement something inside of our health system that hopefully makes a difference. And that's been the whole point of HIPS is doing that, but they've got a lot of, barriers that they're up against, right? These are complicated systems. They've been doing things the way they do things for a long time. And so now you've got to go in and say, hey, you're not doing it right anymore. We're going to do it this new way, which presents a lot of problems, right? Most people don't like to change. I'll tell you one of the big problems I had when I was implementing the small hospitals. So with Emerus, that company that I started, we were implementing small hospitals. And what we would have is people would say, hey, you can't do that. You're going to put my license at risk if you make me take care of one extra patient or help out in the lab, for example. And, you know, when we were up against those barriers, really, we just had to get very, very firm with them and say, hey, this might not be a place for you, because we're the type of organization that's going to try things new. Sometimes it may be on the edge. It's never illegal or unethical. I don't think we've ever done anything unethical in my career, nor would I ever, nor would I allow anybody on my team that did so. But you can't hide behind a badge and not be willing to change because of some almost universally unfounded fear. We've got to be able to try things and try things new. And that's a mentality, to get back to your question, it's a mentality that an organization has to take on. They have to put their innovation hat on and say, okay, we're an innovative organization, and that means we're going to change and we're going to test. And some of these tests are going to fail and fail miserably. And that's okay, because that's part of the process. And if an organization is willing to accept that dynamic, they're well set up to make the type of changes they need into the future. But that's a sea change in the way that they think historically.
Gotcha. Well, anyone who knows anything about Houston knows that you're probably in the right place to be doing all of this, right? I know you're based in the Texas Medical Center. How has, being in Houston affected all of your endeavors that you've, accomplished and started?
A lot more than I would have imagined. Let me say that. I have fallen in love with Houston for its embrace of the entrepreneurial culture. When I get a new idea or a new concept, I need to run it by somebody to see if it works. And people get excited with me and for me, and they want to work with me. I mean, the new company, Hamilton Health Box, it was just an idea that I mentioned to a friend and sat on it for a couple of years. And then one day he called me up and said, hey, remember that thing you talked to me about a few years ago? Will you come try it on me? We're having a hard time with our healthcare spend. and I think you might be able to help me. And I said, well, okay. We dusted off the models and went back to work. And I think that's symbolic of the experiences that Houston, Texas has provided me. The Med Center has been super supportive of the work that we're doing. You know, they let us use the space down here. They'll bring in lecturers who have relevant information. They allow us to connect with other like-minded innovators. And they've really just, they couldn't have been more helpful than they were at some really key points in time in the development of many of the companies and ideas that I've helped form and develop over the my years here.
Yeah, well, speaking of the Texas Medical Center, again, I literally don't know how you've juggled everything over the years, but you also previously led the biodesign program. And I want to talk a little bit about that because I think it might be a program that people don't know about. So tell me about the biodesign program and, kind of what you accomplished over your tenure there.
Yeah, the biodesign program is a super unique program. I love the biodesign program. And after I had sold my first company and started HIPS, the Healthcare Innovators Professional Society, and that had been on its feet and was really operating and growing, the Med Center came to me and said, hey, would you be willing to run this program that we've got? And I said, well, I don't really think so. You know, I don't know if that's something I want to do. And they said, but wait, let me tell you about this program. And at that point, I really started diving into what the biodesign program was all about. And it's really super cool. And the way the TMC does it is different from anywhere else in the country. There's probably somewhere between 5 and 10 biodesign, quote, biodesign programs in the country. But there's only one that really operates it the way that the TMC does that I'm aware of. And that is their goal is a little bit different. Most of the other biodesign programs are academic in nature. And when you finish, you get a degree and you get something to hang on your wall. Our program isn't like that here. This program is designed to have a company that goes to market and is commercializable. And so you don't get a degree or an academic merit badge of any sort. Your whole dynamic, your focus is we're going to form a company that's going to go try to impact one of these problems in healthcare. And so once I heard that, that's what the focus is and that's what we're trying to do and that they've got the resources to support us. It was something that you almost couldn't refuse. It was really cool. So they give us a big block of money. I say a big block, relatively big block of money. And they let me recruit students, although all of my students are MDs, they're PhDs, and they're MBAs. And we put them onto teams. So typically teams of 2 to 3, sometimes 4. And they spend a year under my tutelage in this case, identifying a problem to solve. And I would argue that's almost the most important part is let's try to find a problem that is solvable and that we have a solution to that could be unique and could be commercializable. And that's a big deal. That's really hard to get those three lined up, but they get to spend enough time doing that. They receive a salary from the TMC for doing so that is fairly competitive. It's not competitive for an MD, but it's competitive for someone who's willing to spend a year chasing this. And that group of people spends the whole year. That's all they do. That's their job is trying to invent something new that's commercializable. So we spend a lot of time identifying problems. We start out sometimes with a couple hundred problems and we'll say, okay, I've got a list of 200 problems, and we'll gradually start to narrow that list down to where we get to one problem that we think we can actually make an impact on. We bring in world-class experts, lecturers from Stanford, Duke, and Rice that will educate this cohort of students, if you will. They're really fellows is how we refer to them, on best practices, connecting them to people that are subject matter experts, and then try to get them to launch a company at the end of the program. So when you have a successful year in the program, you are a company and you're out raising funds and you're trying to get customers and you're in the market. And that's what the biodesign program is about. Our version of it here at the TMC is fairly unique. And that has been a really fun and fascinating dynamic for this innovation community here at the TMC. That's something that makes a really big difference. So You can't thank the TMC enough for the way that they were willing to spend those dollars to get those companies up and running. And in my time doing so, we put out, we were doing two a year, but there were a few side extras that came in. So you could argue whether we started 4 to 5 companies over my 2 years here, all of which are still in business today. And are growing and making an impact and being successful. And so that is super rewarding for me personally. But I think for those companies that formed under my tutelage, I'd like to think that they're really starting to make a difference on even more problems. And so we're really getting to multiply our ability to impact healthcare broadly under a program like BioDesign.
That's such an interesting concept to just, get a group together and identify a problem and then find the solution in that way. So thanks so much for kind of explaining that. I had a vague idea of the program and that really helped kind of put it into perspective for sure. So I wanted kind of just to wrap up, talk a little bit more generally about Houston's healthcare innovation world, since I know you're so much of a part of it. Over the years, how have you seen it emerge and evolve? And where do you think we're going as a city in this space of innovating healthcare?
I'll tell you, we had one of the companies here at the TMC Innovation Center sell the other day for $400+ million. Mm-hmm. It's not the first or the second or the third that we're seeing something like this happen. We're seeing this more and more. Houston is absolutely beginning to show up on the national radar regarding healthcare innovation, as we should. We have the world's biggest medical center here. And so most of these companies, if they can sell simply in to the Texas Medical Center, their companies are made, right? Their companies would be successful off of the people that are across the street. And so as a community, if we can get behind that vision and be the place that tests and develops and creates these opportunities, it has the potential to be unlike anything in the world if we really put this thing on steroids. So I'll say that at a high level. And when we get down to lower levels, what I've seen over the last few years is, and I would put this at the last, 5 years. I'll give you an example. Houston Methodist used to sort of process these things at a one-off level. Well, now they've got a whole committee that meets weekly or biweekly, and they're filtering through these ideas and they're reaching out for information from other members of HIPS, for example. But they are really looking at and aggressively pursuing creative solutions, innovative solutions to their biggest healthcare problems. And that didn't even exist 5 years ago. It was zero or close to zero. And now it is a really fundamental and integral part of a Methodist's DNA. And we're seeing this happen across multiple health systems. And Mo Herman has really advanced their innovation team. We're partnered with Memorial Herman in this market, and we're called Memorial Herman Onsite. This is a reflection of their aggressive pursuit of innovation. And so not only are we seeing new things coming out of the TMC Innovation Center, which in itself didn't exist prior to about 7 years ago, right? So we formed an innovation center. It's massive in scope. This is the biggest one in the country, and I would argue it's probably the finest in the country. I visited many of them when I was recruiting people for HIPS and meeting people with their innovation structure. Ours is second to none here, which is reflective, as it should be, of our position as the world's biggest medical center and a healthcare leader. So honestly, we are shifting our innovation vehicle into third gear for the first time. And I'm excited to see what fourth gear looks like, because fourth gear is around the corner. And I'm seeing it more and more. I'm not just saying it. I'm not just broning it. I live in it. This is my home here. And I probably meet a company or two every couple of days that are attempting to really bring about a lot of innovative changes. So I would say Houston's innovation landscape is on the rise to a degree that's really hard to put into words. And it's something that as a community, we should be proud of. I bring people down here to tour them. And when they finish the tour, I almost universally get the response of, holy smokes, I didn't know you had all this stuff. Look at all these incredible things that you're doing. And what you realize is we do have the tools and the resources. And the more we continue to have these victories, so to speak, with successful companies, the more word gets out, the more people come around. And like I said, in the 5 years I've been down here, I've seen it multiply many times over. And it's a real compliment to how this community has embraced that. It needed to, and it had to, and they did. And it's only getting better.
I love that. I'm sure there's a lot of Houstonians listening and just like made so proud by everything you're just saying and excited for the future. And I love that analogy, shifting into third gear. Let's go rev those engines. Here we go. It's Houston's time, right?
Yeah, it is. It's an untapped resource. You know, one of the things that we're doing is trying to find, everything's been oil and gas. And if you want to raise money in oil and gas, it's readily available. There's tons of companies around looking at that and doing that. But here in Houston, we're beginning to shift the attention of some of those organizations to say, hey, look, let's look at this other asset inside of our city that is not getting used the way it could to rev up those innovation engines and to drive the other real value proposition that our city has, right? We're the energy capital, but we're also the healthcare capital. And today, there still aren't very many companies and people coming down and looking at us and saying, hey, let me invest millions of dollars in developing those new ideas. They're coming more and more all the time, but it's an area that I spend a lot of time talking about and educating and trying to get people that aren't used to investing in the life sciences to start thinking about how we have an untapped resource here that really creates a humongous opportunity. Healthcare itself is really messed up. That creates opportunity. And you mix that in with a real entrepreneurial community, which is what Houston is. And it's a recipe for success.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time today and for discussing your many endeavors. Very exciting to hear all of this and your outlook on Houston as well. So thanks so much for your time today, Dr. Hamilton.
Hey, thank you. I was glad to be here. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.